Welcome to session 115. We are a new social and political movement grounded in Mormon sensibilities. And we're excited to have John T. Kessler here. And he's a practicing attorney and active Mormon, and he founded the Salt Lake Center for Engaging Community in order to model best practices of community flourishing in a global environment. And then afterwards, we will hear a response from Joseph West. And so, go ahead and silence your cell phones. I'm glad we're all staying in the middle. And thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Well, we're an intimate group, so I'd like to maybe make this a little less formal than if it was sort of a large group to give a talk to. So what I'll suggest is if I bring anything up and you're really wondering what I just said or want to get into it a little bit more or something, why don't we just, if you're interested, I'm open to sort of questions and answers as we move along a little bit, rather than be too formal in terms of a presentation and a response, and then we talk. So I'll try to keep my eyes open to you out there. So the presumption in the Restored Gospel is that it's better to be more mature rather than less mature. It's better to have a broader scope of caring awareness than a lesser scope of caring awareness. Basically, we're unique in the sense that we do believe that we have sort of these divine genetics, that we have the capacity to grow more and more into our divinity, more and more like the Savior, not just in terms of being obedient, but in terms of greater human capacity and possibility and deeper awareness and deeper and broader capacity for love. And so that creates a presumption in our doctrine that we should give preference to those things that are more mature and more caring and broader in that way. And I'll just sort of run down a list of things that developmental psychologists say are markers of greater human maturity. Greater cognitive complexity, including systems awareness, an increased scope of caring awareness, an ability and commitment for increasingly longer-term perspectives and solutions, rather than just, let's get this solved and deal with this political issue in the next 6 months, but what's going to be the impact on our kids and our grandkids, that type of thing. And an increasing scope of caring awareness would be who ultimately could be impacted by what we're doing here within our community, within our state, within our country, in the world. What's the impact on our global environment? An ability and commitment for, let's say, increasing capacity for connecting with all people so that you really have an ability for people from all walks of life, all levels of maturity, different cultural backgrounds, an ability to connect with them and to make things work for them. An increasing capacity to hold multiple perspectives. And I'll just mention where I think the church as an institution is already kind of leading out in this regard. There was, you might have all heard this comment from the first presidency that they wanted everybody to know that they felt that both major political parties had gospel principles in them that were rather preferencing one or the other. To realize that there wasn't one of the major parties that was had a deficit in that regard. Higher levels of ego development, and that's in developmental psychology, that's sort of one frame of reference for measuring where your center of gravity is in terms of a cognitive, moral, and social awareness. And we can talk about that in a little bit more detail if we have the time or you're interested. And then ultimately, developmental psychologists will talk about when you hit a point where the normal internal and external elements, this is inside of me and this is private and this is my values and that's outside of me, begin to merge, and you just sort of become the change that you want to be. It's sort of, you know, Gandhi's statement, this is the great challenge. It's sort of the deeper spiritual challenge. And how do you just present yourself, be in a group of people, and just by your very presence, you can help bring sort of a centeredness, a spiritual centeredness to that, and sort of align people and help be a peacemaker and a person who can bring people together rather than competing in great, you know, in real polarization. So then my little summary sentence is, all this should yield greater capacity to weave people together in multiple perspectives, to connect and with more people, to meet the needs of all with a higher level of inspired solutions. And a couple of interesting things that, the mainstream church, church leadership, I don't know if all of you are from Utah, but there's this Utah Compact as a solution or an approach, a philosophy towards immigration. It's sort of not just, this is the law, it's black and white, but there are values here and there are people's lives involved and there are unique situations and here's some guiding principles to work this out. It's called the Utah Compact. I thought that was a great example that hasn't gone over well, particularly with the real conservative folks. And also, for instance, saying, "Well, look, we have some policies and doctrines with regard to marriage and heterosexual relationships, but we support civil unions, that everybody ought to be able, if they so choose, to live together and have full rights and opportunities." And so, these are examples of how you weave together. You can hold your own position in terms of, you hold some basic principles involved, but try to reach some kind of a resolution in a societal, in a diverse societal setting, to sort of resolve the issues that you're dealing with in ways that are important to everybody and meet people's needs. There's another really interesting aspect to developmental psychology, which has arisen as sort of a main theme in terms of measuring how people process reality, and it has to do with polarities. And there's this fairly unique scripture in 1 Nephi 2:11, where it not only talks about there's an opposition in all things, but absolutely everything is a compound in one. We tend to talk about polarities as, or in opposition all things, as there's good and there's evil. But that isn't a true polarity. I mean, there's health and there's pathology and there's good and there's evil. But everything else, just like an in-breath and an out-breath, anything that manifests in some kind of compound, and yet is grounded in a deeper unity. And just trying to think of the time that I have, whether I should do this visually or not. I don't think I will take the time, but developmental psychologists would say, in the realm of ideas or concepts, on a certain concrete level, in your childhood, you're given something to understand or to believe. These are the rules, follow them, or this is the truth, follow it. And you can just see one pole and hold one pole. And if you get socialized, that's sort of what you grow into. And reasoning doesn't make much difference. You know, you just hold that position. That's the position you think is right or true, and that's it. As you move into the ability to think abstractly, formal operational thinking, all of a sudden you have the capacity to actually see and begin to understand other points of view. But the first position is, instead of just seeing one, you can see both or see other perspectives, but you instinctively use all your reasoning ability to defend your own position. And so it's like the debating model in high school, as you learn how to defend a position. And that's called the first level of formal operational thinking. The second level of formal operational thinking, which is really should be the minimum level for democratic capacity, is you really develop the capacity to say, okay, this is sort of what I believe, this is what I've been taught, but actually I have a capacity to analyze or evaluate things, and so I can look at this and I can look at that, use my reasoning, I can use all the resources that I have, and then I can come to a fair resolution having thought through it and considered everything that I think I need to consider. And so that's called either-or thinking. It's seeing both poles, being able to consider both poles, and then you choose which is the best one. And that's really where our level of education is, even on a college level, pretty much in terms of supporting that level of formal operational thinking. It was sort of the foundation for the Enlightenment. It's a great gift to mankind. The United States Constitution is grounded in formal operational processing. But then there's another level of thinking, which is called context awareness. And that context awareness says, well, yeah, there are general principles, but there are contexts. Everybody comes from a particular perspective, and you begin to be able to think in terms of systems awareness. And the least mature step of context awareness is, well, there are multiple perspectives, so there's really no truth, and so everything's wrong, and it's really just a matter of power. That's sort of classic postmodernism. That's what you find in graduate schools in English, is you deconstruct everything. But then the more developed form of context awareness is, guess what? Not everybody's wrong, but everybody's right. If you hold a perspective or a position, and it seems to work for you, there's something right with it. And then you start to be able to weave together multiple perspectives and sort of a systems awareness. You develop this own multiplicity of awareness within yourself. Hey, I have all of these things going on inside of me. There's all of these things going on out there. We need to learn how to integrate and weave things together. And so that's sort of a both and. That's sort of a both and perspective. And what philosophy that really has gone into this both and perspective and even the next level of development is called construct aware, not context aware. Is construct aware, you can see that you actually construct a lot of things. Everything that's there, you kind of construct it. But you can sort of see how these perspectives fold together. And the leading integral, and it's called sort of integrals, integral philosophy. The leading integral philosopher about 20 years ago came up with a little chart to help explain political positions from a very simple double matrix that you put together. And I'll just sort of draw it on the board here. Is one matrix is single, and the bottom is plural, or many. And the other matrix is inside and outside. And the primary dividing line between liberals and conservatives is that liberal theory tends to have a perspective from the outside of things. You know, there are systems that can be put together, processes that create fairness and justice, that create an environment and create opportunities. And so we do things in society to make sure everything's fair and there are proper opportunities. Conservatives, on the other hand, tend to think on the inside. It's my own principles, it's my values, it's my cultural integrity. And so this is kind of the great dividing line. And so the interesting thing is, but there's two divisions on each side. This outside plural means you look to sort of social systems and government systems to kind of support and create the environment that you want. And the classic, and this is sort of classic. Liberalism, as we look at it today. In the extreme, it's socialism. The outside freedom aspect is represented by what they call in the 60s the New Left, or what you might call the Occupy Wall Street perspective here. And so that's called freedom liberalism. And in the extreme, that turns into anarchy. And then in the inside plural down here, which pays attention to what are, you know, our social values, our culture, our people, what we believe, what brings us together. That really is a classical conservatism. It's really old line conservatism. Just classical C. Who in the political process that was talking about these are our core values and these are the values that we need to follow was in the Republican primaries, who really, that was sort of his theme. Who was sort of the classical conservative? I'm actually trying to think of his name. But he was the one who surged just before Romney overcame him.
Gingrich?
No.
Santorum?
Santorum. Santorum. And Obama really is closer to classical liberalism. And then this is called freedom conservatism. Just freedom C. And so it's all about liberty and free choice. It's sort of the free market people. It's where a lot of the Republican Party is. The extreme expression of collective conservatism or classic conservatism is fascism, if you go to the extreme. And the extreme of freedom conservatism is libertarianism. And the reason that they can sort of fight and demonize one another and dig in and defend their positions is because everybody's right. They have valid, potent, important perspectives to bring. But the point is, if you can only hold one position and only see your position, or even hold one position, see the others, but only for the purpose of defending your own, you're coming from a place of immaturity. And what we like to say in this civility movement that I've been working with for several years is if you feel the need to demonize people who have different perspectives than yours, not even try to see the other side or not even maybe have the capacity to see the other side, you're either a child or an immature adult. And the problem is, right now, is that our political leadership is becoming more and more polarized, and in this context is becoming less and less mature and more and more ideological, because ideology means you're deeply stuck in your quadrant, and almost every political position you can kind of nail it comes primarily out of one of these quadrants. And the sad thing is I kind of, because I'm aware of this and have been aware of it for years, I watch the language, the background, and the history of candidates and whatnot. It's clear that both Obama and Romney have the capacity to think with multiple perspectives, and yet they're kind of driven, and I think particularly Romney, they're driven to kind of identify with their party base, which is, you know, in a less mature place and in an ideological place. But the shift that's happened in recent years is the political leadership has actually moved further out to the polls, and it used to be historically that most of the political leadership was a little bit closer to the middle, and they could come together and understand each other's perspectives and work things out. And now the general American population is more mature in that sense than our political leadership is, rather than vice versa, which is, you know, the reverse of what should be happening. And so I've worked for many years in this developmental context. About 25 years ago, I started being a civility consultant for the Utah Office of Education, which I've always thought is sort of where you have to start. It's with our kids, because people my age, it's sort of a lost cause. It's not much is going to happen. And over the years, we worked out development, and it was civility, but civility means, we've kind of interpreted it as a civic expression of the golden rule. What's your scope of care and awareness? What's your ability to understand other people's positions? Come up with 7 levels of civility or 7 levels of civil reciprocity, each one tracking in terms of human development as far as what you can possibly handle and what you can sort of get your arms around. And in most civic and public spaces, people function at about 2 levels lower than they normally have the capacity to. So you can facilitate and bring people together and almost automatically raise people to a higher level of processing and capacity in terms of being more inclusive, learning how to listen, learning how to weave diverse perspectives together. And with somebody who's trained, you can bring people to another couple of levels higher than that, which otherwise would just simply never happen. And so about 8 years ago, we started having dialogues with people and say, does anybody who would be interested, if you're concerned about the polarization in our society, what are your concerns and why? And we ran a school program for years that was grounded in the religious liberty clauses of the First Amendment, and out of that developed these dialogues. And people said, well, we have to sort of institutionalize civility within the context of our governmental framework, our constitutional framework. And so we came up with rules for civil discourse and behavior that were grounded in these perspectives. And about 4 years ago, we weren't sure what kind of traction we'd get. But all of a sudden, the governor said, I'm on board. This is great. The Supreme Court said, this is wonderful. Not only that, but let us help you. The Attorney General said, this is wonderful. Let us help you in terms of fine-tuning and integrating it into the constitutional language. We got a joint resolution of both chambers of our legislature, 100% unanimous resolution. We're in support of this. And this is a wonderful document grounded in the Utah Constitution. A year later, absolutely nothing's changed. So it's really easy to say, yeah, this is great, and we can't deny that this is really important. So about 3 years ago, those of who were interested in continuing on with this, said, okay, let's sort of get deeper into the trenches and see if we can build this into Utah society. Given, I don't talk like this other places, but given what our religious assumptions are about preferencing maturity and greater capacity for moral awareness, and given our understanding of polarities, at least implicitly, in the gospel, this would be great territory to sort of lay the groundwork for a social movement that could move people more towards the capacity to understand and appreciate all of this, realize that everybody's right, realize that there are opportunities to bring things together, realize that what people call moderates, those people who sacrifice their principles and try to make deals. I mean, there is a lot of that that's, unfortunate and inappropriate and done for the wrong reasons. But ultimately, it reflects the capacity you would want of the ability to come together to make things work, to realize you've got people stuck in their ideological quadrants, but everybody has something to contribute, and how can you weave something together that works for everybody? So we thought, well, we'll go to the best Republican example and Democratic example that we can find, see if they'd be willing to co-chair an advisory committee to oversee this. So we went to Greg Bell, the Republican, very conservative Republican lieutenant governor. He was just very civil. He always listens. He was a great legislator that way. Then we went to Ralph Becker, the mayor of Salt Lake City. Again, a very civil and understanding, outreach kind of Democrat. And everybody we asked said, yeah, we'll be on this advisory board. So we have a 40-member advisory board representing all segments of Utah society. We created a video for Utah schools, and they're doing training in the schools. I'm doing a monthly conference call with representatives from every college and university in the state to teach these developmental perspectives. We're doing a monthly conference call with every mayor's office in the state. A group called the Freedom Foundation at Valley Forge, which is a very conservative national group that looks for patriotic type of things, gave us a national award. Apparently, without most people realizing that this concept, and we've kind of framed it under the concept of grow up America, or you know, grow up Utah, is that it makes sense people want to do it, but a lot of people haven't made the link that the way they practice politics or the way our political system is working right now is doesn't follow the assumptions of what everybody seems to be in favor of. So my goal has always been, I'm trying to lay the groundwork to launch this beginning next year, after the elections, is a movement called Grow Up America, based on about, you know, this 15 years of laying the groundwork. So the question is, can this actually turn into a social movement? You need resources, you need to be able to connect broadly with people. We've connected beautifully in a non-controversial way around the theme of civility and growing up with every segment of Utah society. So I think the groundwork is there. We have to learn the perspective of how we bring this into the mainstream of the political process, because there'll immediately be opposition by people who work in each one of these. But if you develop the language, and we seem to have developed the language, the people can identify with this and agree that it's a wonderful way to go. And the funding we got, we raised about $50,000 to run this over the last couple of years. The Mormon Church was the biggest funder, and then Zions Bank was another major funder, and then a number of corporations. And the Church Public Affairs Office has tried to get in and back it. They're even working with us on doing a fifth Sunday presentation for the joint brothers and sisters to bring this perspective in. I don't know if it'll actually happen, but the Public Affairs is trying to talk with the hierarchy about the importance of doing this. So we have broad acceptance as far as we've gone. We now need to move out into a more politicized arena. But I'm committed to try this, work on this for the next 4 or 5 years to see if we can get it going. Whether it can really become a broad social and political movement, I mean, that's the big question. And I'm grateful to have a respondent, Joseph West, who that's his area of study, and will really be interested in your thoughts about this. Okay.
Okay, so yeah, I'm Joseph West. I'm a graduate student in sociology. I have three research areas, all of them intersecting around social movements and collective action mobilization. So that's kind of like the perspective from which I'll be responding to this. So I won't really be talking much about the developmental psychology and the integral stuff, so much as kind of my thoughts on what he finished with there about this whole thing as a social movement, and maybe some ideas that dialogue with what the empirical findings are around successful mobilization, these kinds of things. Let me make sure I'm not forgetting something before I jump in. Okay, so I'm going to just briefly, I want to take 10 minutes and save a lot of time for discussion, but talk about three major areas in social movement research that are relevant here, and then focus on one in particular, and that is the literature on framing. To start off, the main kind of perspective in social movement research is called resource mobilization, and that started in this the late 60s with a guy named Manker Olson, who wrote a book, The Logic of Collective Action, which was basically, before that point, collective action had been understood as a function of grievances, meaning like if people are just mad enough, they'll get together, and that's what produces collective action. And so the research questions were always about what makes people upset about different things, what gives arise to grievances. Manker Olson was an economist who basically wrote that, who basically pointed out that there's never a shortage of grievances. There's always a lot of people upset about a lot of things, but people rarely successfully mobilize. And so why is that? And it's basically kind of a classical economic idea about the free rider problem. Is that's why that what prevents mobilization in most cases is this free rider problem of, even if people are upset about something, they most likely won't do something about it because it's in their interest to just hope someone else does something about it, and that's kind of what prevents collective action. And so the question for resource mobilization people was not why are people upset about things, but the question then becomes, why do people mobilize? And that becomes to solve the free rider problem, you need resources. And so once people are able to mobilize resources, then there's an incentive, and it's usually material, to be a part of this collective action. Without that incentive, then collective action never really happens, regardless of how much grievances there are. And he talked a little bit about that, some of the resources, the LDS Church. I was really happy and surprised to hear about that one of the main ways that he's been able to mobilize resources behind this is through the LDS Church and other big sponsors. And that's just kind of like a key. I mean, nothing is ever going to happen without some sort of resource mobilization. Or even if there is, sometimes there is just so much grievances that people just like, you know, it's like mob mentality and people do collectively organize, but those are usually just kind of like explosions that die. The next kind of paradigm or theory is called political process theory. And the framing that I think kind of what he's doing is an exercise in framing. That's why I want to focus on that. There's a lot of empirical literature on framing and what people do to frame, how framing varies across different social movements, and that's kind of part of political process. So what political process theory is basically saying it's not just about the organizational strength or resource mobilization of a particular social movement, but also the political opportunities. So lack of repression. So, I mean, that's a lot about like democratic processes that are in place in a given society without which people would not be able to mobilize. Like if there's repression of social movements, that's a huge preventer of collective action. Also competition. So if in a context, if you're thinking about it economically, about resources that are going to supply, that are going to solve this problem, the free rider problem, there's going to be competition for those resources. And so depending on the different social movements that are competing for resources is going to affect the opportunities that different groups have. But this can also be cultural as well. And this is where I think this presentation comes in, is there has to be cultural salience. There has to be an opportunity culturally for these things to happen. An example actually is the Occupy Wall Street movement, which until that happened, this sort of anarchy, I would say like almost left libertarianism is this quadrant. And until the Occupy Wall Street movement in America, that was actually not even really part of the cultural landscape. Like it wasn't even really on people's radars as a political possibility. And it's still not really. I mean, there's still no viable political candidates generally that are fit into that category. And so that's part of the political opportunity structure, is that in America that's not really an option. I mean, that's obviously arguable. And so really what I think is going on here is an attempt to kind of create that the cultural opportunity, sees what's already there, I mean, he's obviously working within a context to working with Mormon ideas and with these other ideas that he talked about, but also just to create an opportunity to look at a particular segment. In this case, I think the audience is, I mean, for this particular talk especially, although not necessarily generally for his for what he's trying to do, but for this talk in particular, the audience is a Mormon audience saying, you know, this can be this thing grounded in Mormon sensibilities, I think what the title of the talk was, part of the title of the talk. And so I see that as taking the cultural resources that are available and trying to frame it in a way that makes it viable for mobilization purposes, okay? And so that's what I kind of want to focus on. Okay, I did that quick enough. Okay. So, let's see. I don't want to say this. Okay. I think that... okay, I want to touch just briefly on theologically kind of some of the ideas that he's touching on within Mormon thought and how those are framed. So what I would say in terms of this talk, all these ideas are frames that are going to orient action in a particular direction. And that's kind of like what I would be interested in. That's what sociologists would be interested in most, is less about the beliefs and the ideas and more about how those beliefs and ideas orient people towards action one way or the other. And so I just really briefly, I mean, I'm not a theologian, and I don't pretend to be, but I do have some my own take on these things. So so on this on the Second Nephi 2 thing about opposition in all things and being compound in one, I think that the challenge, now I'm 100% on board. Oh, that's something I should have said. I'm totally supportive and on board and like want to see this succeed. So if raising objections is not something like that I'm saying I disagree, it's more saying bringing it into a discussion of how these things can be interpreted otherwise. So I do think that 2 Nephi chapter 2 and those ideas about progression and maturity are absolutely there. They're in the scriptures, they're in the ideas, and the way that I see that personally is opposition all things is referring to a concrete situation of pluralism or where there's just desires that conflict constantly, and the moving towards oneness is this sort of abstraction that we're constantly striving towards. But the thing is, we always find ourselves in the state of the atonement of Christ is an eternal process that's always working itself out. When each of us individually, you know, make covenants and take the name of Christ upon ourselves and act in such a way as to bring about that atonement, but it's never fully realized. So there's always kind of a there's always a present state of conflict and opposition with others, and I know it's about, you know, what you're talking about is about trying to overcome that, and but the question is how that's done and how people, you know, believe that it's going to be done. And so this is kind of like the I think that a big frame that you use that is really relevant is maturity, this notion of maturity. And that's, I think, where there could potentially be a disagreement. Now, I like that it's very empirically based in literature on developmental psychology and how they talk about what maturity is. But I do think that there is a definition of maturity that's kind of like sneaking in the assumption that's going to determine the outcome. And what I mean by that is thinking in particular about family members that I have and observing discourse. I think a lot of people would just say, well, maturity just means coming to a knowledge of this absolute truth that I possess, and you coming to that and accepting that, and that's how we're going to come together. And so it's really not about a mutual process. And I think that that's debatable. I mean, I'm personally on the side of, you know, it is about a relational context always, and not some kind of like external object of absolute truth that we're all orienting ourselves towards. No, it's we're orienting ourselves towards each other in this process of atonement. But I just don't think that that's how everybody sees it. And I think that there's, you know, good reasons empirically not be as hopeful that that's possible with Mormons because of and I think there's historically particular reasons for that, but that particular interpretation, I think, is kind of like the real challenge. And that's what this framing idea is all about, is like, how can they be successful, and how can this frame that you're kind of trying to establish here be successful and take root with people? So I think that's kind of like, I think the big objection, not again, I agree with it on a personal level, but in terms of how Mormons are oriented, you know, based on like the empirical evidence of where they stand politically and towards moral issues, that's kind of the thing I think is a difficult. So I think that like what people would say is, well, when you talk about maturity, you're just trying to back, they would be suspicious of that and say, you're just trying to sneak in your liberal ideas through the back door, you know, but really that's not what maturity is. Maturity is just about coming to a knowledge of the truth and accepting that, and you know, then the discussion is over. Let me just go through sort of like prescriptively go through three kind of subtopics under framing that are and maybe suggest some things. So basically, there's three core framing tasks, like what the purpose of framing is in a social movement. The first is diagnostic framing, and this is basically like problem attribution, identification, and I think that this is where it's really strong. Well, but it's strong in part because of the articulation of it, but in part because I think everybody realizes that political discourse in our culture right now is there's lots of problems with it. So the next core framing task is called prognostic framing. And this is articulation of a proposed solution to the problem, sort of like a plan of attack and strategies. And this is where I think that there are specific things that you've talked about with that. But I think it could be more clear, like, you know, more specifics. I think that you're kind of in a tough situation there, though, because when you're talking about the diagnostic frame, when you're talking about the problem, it's very you're abstract purposefully, because that's where everybody can agree. Everybody can agree on these kind of like more abstract principles, but then the more you start to focus in, the more I think that becomes, that's where these like people, the red lights will start going off in their mind of, oh, he's just trying to, you know, sneak in some liberal ideas, and that's, but I think that in terms of prognostic framing, which means, you know, articulating proposed solutions, it could be more specific about what it is exactly you want to do about that. And then the last core task is motivational framing. And this is really related to prognostic framing, of course, but this is basically like providing a call to arms, putting forth a rationale for engaging in ameliorative collective action, including the construction of proper vocabularies of motive. And so again, this is kind of where I was talking about the motive frame how that orients people. If you have the maturity frame, that's a big part of what you're talking about, is like, let's all focus on this Mormon idea of progression and being more mature. And that's kind of like, how does that orient people towards action? Well, that totally depends on what they think maturity means. And so there's got to be a way to kind of like orient action in a particular way that's more specific, that, you know, plants within people's minds what it is that maturity means in terms of what you're actually talking about. I've said some of this. and you talked about an increasing capacity to connect with other people, and I think that that's something that everyone would claim to desire, but the question is how that comes about. And again, I think a lot of people would say, well, the way that comes about is through you accepting my truth, and then we'll come together and connect, which is obviously not what you're talking about. And then the other big thing that I want to say, a couple more points. I think that in terms of the way you're dealing with Mormon theology, what I was thinking of, I just had this thought when I was sitting there, is that it's reminiscent of, I think, kind of like Gnostic movements within Christianity that are focused on consciousness and awareness. And I think that that is presents a challenge in that those kinds of things that are focusing on the ideas and the doctrine for the purpose of pushing people towards greater consciousness and awareness of the of people around them are historically and empirically usually kind of an elite thing, like a something that requires a lot of distance from necessity. It requires a lot of education. So the people that are really capable of digesting these ideas and processing them in the way that you would like to see, I think are people who are in a social position that's different from basically like the masses, you know, who are not in a position of distance from necessity in the same way. And I think that that's always something that intellectual movements have to worry about is seeing how their framing connects with people who are not in this elite is maybe the wrong word, but in a particular social space where they're capable of spending lots of time thinking about these ideas instead of just, you know, their material everyday needs. And then the last point that is how, okay, so in framing, this is another thing that happens in a framing process is that it is this dynamic of movement framing versus counter-movement framing and how those frames change. So I think that the best thing you can do, so I've kind of raised some possible responses to what you're saying. The big one I think being is like, well, you're begging the question about what maturity means. Again, that's not my response. That's a response you could get. So I think that anticipating those kinds of responses and understanding how your frames will either have to change or, you know, there will be this back and forth between movement and counter-movement framing that I think you need to be aware of. So I think that that's what I got. So I loved the paper. It was great, so...
Now we'll open up for a question answer period. I have a quick question I wanted to ask. I really like Joseph's last point about bringing it to practical dialogue with the people who are not intellectualizing it like we are today. And so my question would be, I love the opposition in all things framework, the progression, call to civility, and that's where I want everyone to go. But how would you practically respond to the counter-argument from a Mormon perspective of integrity and holding your position and being strong in your convictions? How would you respond to let go of that and to be more open to dialogue?
Well, I think to begin with is to acknowledge that my estimation of the developmental center of gravity of Mormon culture is probably less high than the culture at large to begin with. So I think that's, you know, it's definitely an issue and it begs the whole question. However, our own church leadership is an attractor to, you know, this compact for immigration, saying you have to think about more than this narrow conservative position or the support for civil union. So I think we have some great leadership that is coming from this higher place that we can point to and justify and help connect with people who otherwise are going to be going to be stuck. And so I think we have some great examples in that way. And then the really basic developmental theory here is accepted 100% in grade schools and middle schools and high schools and higher education, and nobody's opposing it. So I think if we can use this framing to help people, particularly in our church, understand we have the best theological grounding for it than any other philosophy, religion, or anywhere, that we can get a lot of support out of the Mormon community for this, even though most of the Mormon community politically is stuck in a fairly ideological and not very mature position, in my estimation. Are these things recorded?
I think it is.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Kind of a comment question is that the moment I heard, immaturity, grow up type of thing, immediately turned off by that phraseology just because it seems polarizing all in itself and entrenching. And it's not a call to, it's more of a guilt. And so maybe address that.
Yeah, my response to that is we found over several years that that's the framing that worked the best, that actually had no resistance whatsoever, that everybody would say, oh yeah. I mean, intuitively, everybody knows that people want to see things worked out. They want to have somebody who has enough wisdom and capacity to bring people together and say, let's work this out. And it's sort of the political process that's being really immature and ultimately getting stuck. And so it was kind of a surprise to me, but it's why I've ended up with this Grow Up America, Grow Up Utah theme, is because when it's framed correctly and people can just sort of reflect on it a little bit, that it seems to work with people. I mean, so that's my answer. I don't know why, but that we've moved in that direction because it seems to work, which would be, it's sort of counterintuitive, I agree, but it seems to work.
Sorry if you did mention this already, but was that broadly, was the response broadly approving on both sides of the aisle for that, or was it more from...
You know, there's been no aisle about it. I mean, we've done a video for all the schools, we're doing monthly trainings and online trainings with all the colleges and universities and all the mayor's offices. Everybody sees this as not an ideological thing. And to kind of, as an example of how you frame this, how you actually do this, we pulled together a Utah Health or Wellness Policy Summit that's bringing all of the perspectives together and grounded in the perspective that nobody's paying enough attention to wellness and how this works. And so if we have the right kind of conversation, we're going to touch on the area that's least paid attention to, that needs the most attention, that's going to realign all of the institutions. And all of a sudden, the Kaiser Permanente healthcare system, the biggest integrated healthcare system in the country, says, we've heard about this, we want to be a part of it. Public Health Institute, the largest public health institute, private foundation in the world, said, we've heard about this, let's help advise you on this. Maybe this could be a template for something that could happen nationally. So we're trying to come up with some practical examples, and there's no resistance to it because it isn't framed ideologically. It's framed on the wisdom of bringing together multiple perspectives and weaving something together that works for everybody.
But do you know what the political demographics of the respondents you've already talked to are? I mean, could it be possible that, I mean, I'm just presenting a devil's advocate here, but could it be possible that most of the people who have responded are more, say, engaged in an urban environment and possibly trend a little bit left or vice versa? I don't know. Do you know what the political persuasion of these responsive groups has been? Or?
Well, I mean, we're just really starting this thing in a way and doing it in the least controversial way possible. But on our 40-member advisory board, we've got very conservative legislators. We've got very liberal legislators. Our co-chairs are a liberal Republican, a liberal Democrat, and a conservative Republican. So, I appreciate the question because these are the things that are really going to happen when we get out there and frame it as a political you know, in a political way, how is this going to impact the political system? And I don't know how to answer those things. But so far, we've been working with it over the years, so how do we frame this in a way that's, you know, very non-controversial?
Thanks.
And it looks like we're about out of time, so this will be the last question.
So it looks like just because you live here, you're trying to perfect this model in your own backyard. Is there a risk that this becomes a Utah model as opposed to trying to go more, you know, across the United States and then come back to Utah type of thing, since I think Utah might be the last to get traction as opposed to the first?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real concern, a real possibility. I mean, I have run the National Healthy Communities Organization and have worked with about a dozen community movements across the country and have traveled around a lot. So we had the option of trying to start broadly, but my instinct about it is to make something work locally and move from there. But I think there's a real chance that maybe we hit the boundaries of Utah and it kind of dies. But, you know, anyway, so I'm excited and appreciated not only Joseph's comments, but his advice as we've talked privately, and appreciate your coming. And hopefully you'll see something about this in the next year or so.